This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll revisit our conversation with Harry Vandeveld of the South Shore Leadership Center about the upcoming Vision Project. And we'll also bring you Sharon Jackson's conversation on how gasoline prices here in Northwest Indiana are faring these days. A little later, we'll bring you some of the highlights of one of the segments of Congressman Pete Fisklosky's recent town hall series of meetings here in Northwest Indiana. We visited the one that was held at Purdue Northwest, and we'll bring you some of the comments made at that. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Vision Project asks the question, accused of having a big vision, and it's a project that is being worked on by the South Shore Leadership Center. And with us to tell us more about it today, we have the Executive Director, President, and CEO of the South Shore Leadership Center, Harry Vandeveld, with us. Harry, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks for having us. We really appreciate it, Chris.
What is the Vision Project and the thinking behind it?
South Shore Leadership Center is founded on a couple of significant yet very clear principles. Mm-hmm. And one of those revolves around making sure that we allow for as much information with specific topics that affect the region to be presented to leaders so that they can, in fact, analyze and discuss and then at the end of that create an activation or an engagement stance. So we are using the Vision Project as an opportunity to take a topic that's very important to the region and invite leaders from all over the region to come learn from outside of the region experts and engage with an observation paper that will be created by Purdue Northwest observers who are in the room, and to be able to make a statement to the region with regard to the topic. And the topic this year is on the importance of tourism and how it affects the quality of place in Northwest Indiana.
I think that's probably one of these topics that people make an assumption that it's always there, that somebody's always planning for tourism, but it is something that you do have to think about, and maybe it's time to do some new thinking. And I'm sure this is a great opportunity to be able to get these ideas together from everybody that might be involved in this and say, what do we do to promote tourism, to develop tourism in our particular section of the state?
Exactly. The more that we can spend time together in a room sharing, being collegial, and developing collaborative approaches, the better off we are. And in particular, I think one of the quiet parts of our economy that, as you say, kind of is an assumed motivator or generator in the economy is tourism, mm-hmm. when in fact we have to spend more time working with the Convention and Visitors Authority, the chambers, local businesses, the mayors and councils, and all of the government officials from Indianapolis on up, to make sure the region is positioned correctly to advance because of investments in travel and tourism. Facilities and initiatives, and for the region to, in fact, be the beneficiary of all of the good things that come from that. Mm-hmm. People may come in for 4 or 5 days on a conference or a tournament, but the assets that are created and left behind are all for the benefit of the people living in the region. And that includes employment. The more that we look at and view tour and travelism as an economic engine, the more we can really focus on building the right facilities, which employs the trades, and then employing the right amounts of people from the region mm-hmm. in those facilities.
Now, the South Shore Leadership Center is going to be involving some big names in Northwest Indiana involved in this Vision Project, the very first one here dealing with tourism. By the way, the sessions where we're going to discuss this are coming up here, starting with a reception on February 6th, and then the big program all day long on February 7th. Harry, tell us a little bit about some of the people that are involved in this, and in particular, how they're going to be fitting together on the symposium that really happens, and where the real discussion and the real brainstorming can happen on the 7th.
You bet. February 6th is the opening reception, and anybody who's interested in being a part of the day, of course, we'll get the plug in now. Go to South Shore Leadership's website, and you can be a part of the February 6th for $50 for the cocktail party, and come to meet and hear a little bit from our MC, Mike Schrag, CEO of Centier Bank, and Roger Rickard. And Roger is one of the leading authorities in the United States of America on conference and meeting initiatives for regions. Mm-hmm. February 7th is 8 o'clock until 5 o'clock day at the Halls of St. George, where we have a number of different opportunities for people to come to understand the importance of tourism and really get into the kind of into the weeds or get granular with regard to it. So we have a nationally recognized individual named Bill Geist, who serves on a number of different national travel tourism boards, and Bill will be giving his perspective on the region. We're going to look at a couple of panels with successes that have been found in the region. So reaching into and talking with folks from everything from mayor office to the national parks and other opportunities. I think one important panel that folks might get a real charge out of will be, we're bringing in the people that run the visitors authorities from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Indianapolis, and Rockford, Illinois.
Wow.
And they're going to talk about their successes as well as the challenges that they face as they advance their tourism and travel programs.
Now, these are people that are they're sparrows body status as colleagues in the business, aren't they?
That's correct. Yep. And we wanted to, and we know that Indianapolis is a little bit outside of the apples and oranges kind of a thing, but Indy has such a big effect on the state, and we wanted to make sure that folks had a chance to hear what was going on down in Indianapolis with regard to travel and tourism. I think the other thing that may be very exciting for folks to be a part of is we know that the RDA has been sponsoring a feasibility study with regard to a conference center, mm-hmm, or a conference center hybrid to help meet the needs of the region now that the Radisson had closed up. And so CSL is the company, and Bill Kruger is the principal. He's going to share his thoughts with the group at lunchtime with regard to what he's heard in the region concerning the most appropriate place to put a structure. And alongside of leading experts nationally, Bill Sheldrick, and he'll talk about how the mechanisms exist for funding the creation of those types of buildings. So that could be really one of the real standout parts of the day. And then the last real outside-of-the-box individual, but a great thinker with regard to regions and what partnerships can exist, we're bringing in President Tom Haas, who's the president of Grand Valley State University.
Mm-hmm.
And President Haas is going to be now working closely with President Tom Keehan at Purdue University Northwest in the fact that PNW has become an NCAA Division II school. So as PNW moves into the GLIAC conference as a NCAA Division II school, we're going to try and find out from President Haas, who is the president of a university that's already in the GLIAC, how universities can really develop powerful partnerships and help the university and the region move forward. So really a wide variety of presentations and topics with regard to what I believe is something that all leaders in the region should have a good sense for, and that is this thing called travel and tourism.
Mm-hmm. This is, by the way, by coming up here with this all-day seminar that will happen on February 7th at the Halls of St. George, and is preceded, of course, the day before by an opening reception. Something to check out here if you're interested in finding out more or being participant in the idea of tourism and promoting tourism in Northwest Indiana. We're talking with Harry Vandeveld, who's the president and CEO of the sponsor of the Vision Project, South Shore Leadership Center. Harry, for folks that are not familiar with the center itself, I know this is the big project coming up here, but you're involved as an organization with a lot of other things as well, too, and some interesting things that are underway that deal with such topics as philanthropy and even working with nonprofits. Tell us about that, please.
You bet. And in fact, we are so thrilled to be a partner with Lakeshore Media with regard to our philanthropy roundtables. The Lakeshore Media was kind enough to record our first five sessions that are now available on YouTube. And we wanted to be able to make sure that we presented a fee-free opportunity for leaders in the not-for-profit world to be able to build their toolbox with a series of different presentations on everything from how to communicate your vision more effectively to how do you, in fact, become a better team builder. We know that non-for-profits in many cases are smaller teams with an expectation to have larger deliverables oftentimes than you'd think it could come out of a two- or three-person shop. And so we wanted to be able to help those leaders build their teams more effectively. And we look forward to moving forward on that in the coming year. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we're looking to collaborate once again with Lakeshore Media as well as the Association of Fundraising Professionals of Northwest Indiana.
That's great.
The AFP-NWI.
Well, some great projects that have been that are underway right now, but of course this one in particular that is coming up here, that if you're interested in finding out more about how tourism can be best organized and best promoted here in Northwest Indiana now and in the future, a great opportunity that the Vision Project, which it was this particular project is being called, is starting out dealing this year with the idea of tourism in the region. And the project is going to offer its opportunity to find out more on February 6th, with starting out with a reception, and then all day long on February 7th at the Halls of St. George. And if you're more interested in this particular seminar that lasts all day, and all of it, you can go on to the South Shore Leadership Center website and find out more and sign up for this too. Harry Vandeveld, President and CEO of the Center, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate all you do for the region, and we look forward to seeing you at the event.
Once again, South Shore Leadership Center is getting started with the Vision Project this year. They're focusing in this particular year of 2018 on tourism here in Northwest Indiana. And the program that's going to bring out the most interest will be the all-day-long seminar on February 7th at the Halls of St. George, where a number of people coming in, the experts dealing with tourism and other places, can offer some ideas and get some response here in Northwest Indiana. Gas prices this winter are turning out to stand apart from other winters.
Average retail gasoline prices in Northwest Indiana have risen about over 3 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $2.57 on Sunday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 314 gas outlets in Northwest Indiana. This compares with the national average that has increased almost 4 cents per gallon in the last week to $2.52 per gallon, according to gasoline price website GasBuddy.com. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for GasBuddy.com, says this winter's prices have been different from past winters.
This is the time of year when we see usually among the year's cheapest gas prices, and that certainly is not holding true or probably won't hold true this time around. Gas prices in the last week took a jump up. Average prices in Northwest Indiana about 3 cents a gallon higher than where they were last week.
But DeHaan says that doesn't tell the whole story.
We saw gas prices mid last week take a big jump up. They've started to trickle back down for the time being. This comes as oil prices still stubbornly high, amongst the highest they've been since late 2014. And that's what we have to thank for gas prices that average about $2.57 today. About 35 cents higher than where prices were a year ago.
According to Gas Buddy historical data, gasoline prices on January 15th in Gary have ranged widely over the last 5 years. At $2.22 per gallon last year, $1.75 a gallon in 2016, $1.82 per gallon in 2015, $3.31 in 14, $3.20 in 2013. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
I actually started going to Morgan Park Academy in the seventh grade. The reason I started going there is my father went to the public school that I was attending, Fort Dearborn. When he got there, he talked with the teacher, and the teacher noted some problems that I was having, hanging with the wrong crowd, and the teacher asked my father if I was interested in having him go to another school. So they ended up putting me in private school and taking me out of public school in the seventh grade. I was what you call a latchkey kid, meaning you stay home until the parents came home at 2-3 in the afternoon, and then you could go out. But until then, you stay in the house. You don't let anyone in the house. I was always told to work on homework after school. So for 2 hours after school, I would have to sit and make sure I worked on homework. But I was rather lazy and mischievous in the classroom. Just getting into a lot of trouble, a lot of referrals to the principal's office, not paying attention in class, just not really being focused on what I needed to academically. And I guess he saw something that said, hey, you know, this kid could go either way unless his parents kind of step in and do something different with him. My family wasn't an affluent family. Both of my parents were postal workers. So they worked that postal shift night and day, rain, sleet, or snow. And they put me in private school, which was a bit of a culture shock for me because I was then in a school with kids that had more affluent families, meaning they were doctors, lawyers, politicians, things of that nature. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me in the beginning because I would have to travel about an hour to get to the school, so taking the bus one way while my other friends and people that I knew and grew up with in the neighborhood were going another way was a bit of a transition. I remember my uncle used to take me to school in the seventh grade, and my uncle drove a cab. So my uncle would drop me off right in front of the school in this big old Beetle Volkswagen-looking taxi cab, and the kids would ask me, why do you drive a cab to school? And I remember very vividly telling them, my parents are so rich that they had to hire a cab for me because I was embarrassed about, you know, coming to school in a cab when other kids were getting there in BMWs and Audis and, you know, other, you know, bigger cars. And I remember an embarrassing moment, and I think my uncle caught on. I never asked him if he did. But in the seventh grade, I acted like I had a basketball injury and I was limping because I was getting teased so much about coming to school in this cab. I had him stop a little further back and told him, you know, I wanted to walk this injury off. So the biggest transition I had to make was in the academics. The real first exposure I had to what you would call honors classes, and then just the reading levels that those kids, you know, those kids were reading novels in the seventh grade, and I don't think I would have read a novel until I reached high school if I had stayed in public school. I also remember very vividly attending that school, it being more of a diverse culture. That was the first time that I really experienced going to school with white kids, kids of international nature, whether it be Indian, Korean, Chinese. So I think in a lot of ways it prepared me for coming to Valparaiso University, but my experience in high school was quite different because I would still go home and it would still be my neighborhood and I could still fit in. My friends helped me stay grounded.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Air pollution contributes to high asthma rates in many U.S. cities, and that's a big problem for blacks and Latinos. They face a lot of exposure to a harmful form of pollution. Angelica Morrison looks at the problem for Great Lakes Today's series on environmental justice.
Marion Motley Playfields is a park on Cleveland's east side. Named for a local pro football star, it has grassy fields, baseball diamonds, and hills. But those fields hide a troubling history. Parts of the property were used as a storage yard for a brick and tile plant, and a stream became an industrial sewer. Vera Brewer remembers playing amid the debris with cousins decades ago, and the time an aunt came to get them and stepped on a rusty nail.
Had it been that we was not playing in the dump, she would have never had her foot injured. But that's where we played. That's where everybody played. We didn't know not to be there because of contamination. Our mindset was on enjoying life.
The area was transformed into a park in the 1960s. Its past was covered up and the stream filled with material from Republic Steel.
Like a big park.
Especially in the
it's
fall.
It's huge. Yes.
On a recent sunny afternoon, James Miles walks through the park, reminiscing about his time spent there as a kid.
We used to call it the dump, but it's a field. We used to come down here in the wintertime. We get our slaves.
Today, environmental pollution remains. A report last year revealed metals in the ground, including arsenic and lead. The city's capital projects director, Matt Spronz, says those chemicals, along with many others, existed in soil samples and groundwater at levels higher than state standards.
Back in those days when people filled in property, whether it was in their backyards or whether it was anywhere else, there was no Environmental Protection Agency or Ohio EPA, and the materials they put into those areas were unknown, right, at the time.
Now officials plan to put a 2-foot soil barrier over the ground to keep kids safe from the chemicals. Playing in lead-contaminated soil can hinder brain development, especially for children. There are properties all over the country that were once landfills, dumps, or uncontrolled toxic waste sites. And these sites tend to be located in communities of color, according to reports commissioned by the United Church of Christ. Texas Southern University professor Dr. Robert Bullard was an author on one of those reports.
Racism trumps income and class when it comes to many of these environmental facilities that historically they've gone to the path of least resistance.
In Chicago, there was a toxic donut of landfills and industrial facilities. It's finally getting cleaned up, but legacy pollution remains. In East Chicago, Indiana, it's the USS Lead site, one of the most contaminated in the country. Nationally, the EPA reports that 45% of people of color live within 3 miles of a Superfund site, places highly contaminated by hazardous waste. And living near these sites can bring lots of problems: odors, noise pollution, and depressed home values. Then there are the potential health impacts. While it's difficult to prove a direct connection to serious conditions like cancer, scientists suspect living near landfills or waste sites can make people sick. And while there are thousands of Superfund sites, there are likely more like Marion Motley, not as contaminated, but still unsafe. Back at the park, Miles is happy the city is working to finally clean it up.
If there's any kind of contamination down here at all, I'm more than excited to see it finally getting the attention that it needs.
Meanwhile, other communities continue to fight to expose the unseen but lasting impacts of the region's industrial past. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
And coming up in Part 3, a look at water pollution among Canada's First Nations. Great Lakes Today is a journalism collaborative of public radio stations WBFO Buffalo, New York, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester, New York. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Congressman Pete Bisklosky had held his recent town hall meetings across the 1st District this past weekend. One of them was in Hammond at Purdue University Northwest's Room with a View. And here are some of the comments made by citizens and Congressman Pete Bisklosky's answers.
Do you personally agree with the FBI director's belief that the FBI's inability to access data from citizens' electronic devices because of powerful encryptions is an urgent public safety issue? Do you believe societies and nations advance or decline in direct proportion to their citizens of privacy and freedom? Balancing the issue of privacy and security is a very difficult one. I would tell you, given the position I serve on the Defense Appropriations Committee, and we fund the 17 intelligence agencies of this country, I'm also an ex officio member of the Intelligence Committee. In trying to, again, find that balance to collect intelligence internationally, not domestically, for the protection of our citizens, and balancing that with privacy is very difficult. I appreciate the person who has asked the question today, because literally yesterday in the House, we had a vote on this issue called essentially 702. As many of you may recall, after the events of 2001, the Patriot Act was adopted. I had very serious concerns then about the protection of people's basic rights and rights to privacy, and I opposed it. I opposed the legislation on the floor yesterday. I would suggest that I do believe in sincerity in a bipartisan fashion. Both sides of the aisle did their very best to move from my perspective, in the right direction as far as the right to privacy, to seek that balance in a more fulsome fashion. But from my perspective, again, looking out for our interests, I don't think they were there yet and voted against it, because I think that is a very key right we all continue to possess as citizens. My husband is a holder of a green card and has been for many decades. Should I worry? I would tell you no. And I find it unfortunate, again, given the tenor of the time, that pronouncements and statements and some actions by federal officials cause citizens to be afraid, and to cause those who are here, who have obeyed our laws, who have participated in the process, are now afraid. I cannot, any more than any of you, project what the future is going to be. And there clearly are a number of outstanding issues relative to immigration that are pending before the United States Congress. I do not believe a change in the green card status or the potential desire to deport those who possess those, because those individuals are legally here and have been in the United States, is going to be one of the subjects of that debate. The last two cards are related, so I'll read them both and then answer. Will the Republican Party succeed in destroying Special Counsel Mueller's investigation? Legally, can there be another Saturday night massacre involving Robert Mueller? As I think everyone in the room understands, Mr. Mueller was appointed as a special counsel to investigate the invasion of the electoral process last year by the Russian government. He was appointed by the Deputy Attorney General. Again, I do not like to project or hypothesize on circumstances that have not happened, but the question has been raised, what if the president wants him fired? I appreciate that one of the two cards relate back to a circumstance in 1973 when, if you remember, in Indiana had a key player in that scenario. Archibald Cox was fired. The president asked Elliot Richardson to do it. Elliot Richardson resigned. He asked Mr. Ruckelshaus, Bill Ruckelshaus, who's from Indiana and widely respected by people such as myself, to do it. He resigned. And ultimately, the Solicitor General, Mr. Bork, did do the deed. Within 10 days, the outcry of the American citizens led the administration to appoint Leon Jaworski as special prosecutor, and we know how that ended. I would hope, and I say this having attended the investiture service yesterday of our new U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Indiana, that people in the administration understand that the purpose of Mr. Mueller's investigation is to find the truth, not fault, and that's why he was appointed. Ultimately, as an individual member of Congress, as a member of the minority, I could not prevent the president from trying to precipitate some type of action to have Mr. Mueller fired.
Hello. President Trump is in the news for some more raunchy positions. And at a time like this, I feel that extraordinary leadership is needed. Sometimes I go to see what my representatives are saying about this, and I never find anything. I look in different platforms. I'd like to see real pushback every time he does this. You know, like, it's fine if Anderson Cooper does something like this, but I want to see my representatives, my senators, push back whenever he does things like this. That's my comment.
Ma'am, I guess I would respond, because the question's directed to myself, is that the president says a lot of things. And I'm not trying to be cute. And the president tweets a lot. You have elected me, whether you agree with my election, whether you agree with all my decisions or not, to work hard for you every day to make this nation secure, to grow our economy, to renew the economy in Northwest Indiana. And I try to work at that. I think it is counterproductive to respond every time, whether it's the president or one of my other colleagues, says something I may disagree with, or I think is outlandish or rude or untrue or vulgar. I'd spend all my day doing that in some instances.
We'll follow
up. And so I would say, when there is an action that is taken that needs to be remediated, I do act. And I would point out my opening remarks. The president talked and talked and talked and talked all of 2016 about how much he loved Buy America provision. And then he eliminated the five that are in the defense bill. Four of which are related to the domestic steel industry, and another one that deals with high technology in this country. I was not silent. I was not inactive, and those are all back in that legislation. And I would also suggest, as you watch the media, I hesitate to use the word news necessarily, and I'm being serious about this too, think about all the people you don't see every night or morning or afternoon. Those are the people I'm working with, because they're working. And it is the majority of the United States Congress. It is the majority of both parties. You have had, unfortunately, and it is destructive to getting things done. It's we're in the 104th day, we don't have a budget for this country. I'm appalled that the extremes have hijacked the public debate in this nation, and it is incumbent. People here throughout Northwest Indiana, our country, stop it. Talk to each other. Don't yell at each other. So when I believe it matters on the interests I represent, I do act. I just think it's counterproductive to my time to respond to everything.
About a year ago on one of the talk shows, they were talking about steel imports from China, and I recall one of the speakers making a comment that China at that time had enough steel on the ground to supply the world's demand for the next 5 years. Is that true?
You are reasonably close to the truth. Let me put this in perspective. Today, internationally, and kind of depending, and it's a raw estimate, conservatively, there's about 600 million excess tons, that's excess tons, not tons in production, to 700 million excess tons. That is, you couldn't use an ounce of that steel to do anything. That's extra than we consume on the entire globe. It's estimated at least 400 million tons of that is in China, if not more. And to put the numbers in perspective, as I reminded the people in East Chicago, if we poured every last ounce of steel in the United States that we're capable of this year, maybe we'd pour 110 million tons. So it's off a little bit, but it's a serious problem. The issue I testified before the ITC last week did not involve China, but I would suggest to you most of those 12 did. And one of the problems, and it is not exclusive to China, but they are at the top of the list, is just about the time we're successful with the Commerce Department and ITC, and there's a limitation on the imports, there's going to be a duty on the import to compensate for them undercutting the price, they move on to product two. And what they will then do with the first product is send it to, I say, Vietnam. I'm in Vietnam, I stamp it as Vietnam, in a sense, well, that's different steel. No, that's the same steel. It's called circumvention. It's also a violation of international law, harder to verify. And one of the things that I continue to work on is to make sure that the Customs Department, the person working that dock when that steel comes in, or any other good or product, could be agricultural product, one is properly trained, knows what to look for. Is that steel defective? Is it violative of an existing quota or duty? And to initiate an investigation on the spot. Since you heard that program, I would say one positive change in the federal law, and again, it was passed in a bipartisan fashion, was to empower to a greater degree customs officials who are at that dock in Long Beach or in Birds Harbor, to empower them to start an investigation right then. And they also now have put a time limit on that investigation, because the other problem we face here is even when we're successful, these processes take so long that you're out of business. The country that violated our law pays the fine, cost of doing business, and now they got the market to themselves. A second law that we passed in the last Congress, and again, bipartisan and it worked in improvement, is to expedite the process at the ITC. You can imagine, I talked about India, Indonesia, and South Korea. Well, we're not going to cooperate. We're not going to send our economic data. We're not going to send our statistics. We're just not going to cooperate. Well, then we're waiting around for 4 or 5 months. Meantime, you're going out of business. Now the ITC is empowered to impute those numbers and that information under existing international standards, historical records. They can't make things up, but they can now somewhat take the initiative themselves to compress that time frame, because that's the other way we get grievously hurt, even when we win. China is not our friend. They are not our friend. And they are, as we meet here, trying to steal every last scrap of intellectual property from every business in Hammond, Indiana right now, and Purdue University. Other than that, I don't have an opinion.
I have another question. Regarding our uranium, did we actually sell 20% of our uranium to Russia? Can you kind of bring us up to date?
Where do you go for your news? No, I'm kidding you.
I think you know where.
I know where you're going. Uranium-1 is a very legitimate question. There was a Canadian firm that was doing business, uranium mining, in the United States of America. A Russian firm had a minority interest. In 2010, the Russian firm bought the company out, majority ownership, for mining uranium for commercial purposes, not for weapon-grade development. It has to be approved during the campaign of 2016, and subsequently, charges were made that Secretary Clinton put the deal in. That is simply not true. The fact is there were 9 agencies of the United States government, including the Treasury Department, as well as state and others, that had to approve this business transaction for the production and mining of uranium. I would point out, after those 9 agencies agreed, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission still had to go through a licensing process and approval, and you had to ultimately have administration request approval. So the idea that one person put a fix in and now the Russians are using this for weapons is not true. But there wasn't a transaction with a Russian firm in 2010.
But the uranium did leave the country?
I don't know. I'd have to get back to you to that as to whether it was sold domestically, internationally, part and part. I don't know. If you want the answer to that, see somebody at the back. I'd be happy to get back to you.
Sure.
And anybody else that would want that answer, please see somebody at the back. Yes?
I'm just now starting to get my feet wet with politicians and stuff, and I wanted to know, like, exactly, basically, besides your job experiences and getting you a job, because I know that was, played a major role in it, but what do you think helped you get to where you are today?
Huh. Mom and Dad. And I'm serious about that. And my sister and a couple of working very hard. And I'm being serious about that. I read a book review recently, and Eddie Murphy was quoted. I mean, it struck me, and I said, "Gee, there's a guy I can identify with." He says, "If you and I get on a treadmill, you're going to die before I get off the treadmill. I will outwork you no matter what." I have two sons who are adults. I've suggested to them, life isn't perfectly fair. There's no question about that. But I said, I will, and I don't bet. I haven't bet on a thing since 1976, and if you want to ask about that, I'd be happy to talk to you. I would always bet on the person who works the hardest. And maybe one out of 10 times, one out of 20 times, that person doesn't win. Put your head down, work hard, try to get the job done. I'm being absolutely serious about this. I won an election, didn't know it until the next day. Three candidates, three-way race, there was a fourth candidate, 2 percentage points. It was a close run thing. And one at a time, over a 15-month period of time, I knocked down almost 44,000 doors one at a time.
I heard you walked the whole district.
Pretty close. Not the whole. I can't lie to you. I can't lie. And it wasn't 44,000, but I came doggone.
Thank you for coming out today. I have a small question. Do you think that government should be run like a business? And if not, why?
Yeah, the question is, should the government be run like a business? If not, why not? And I would suggest that the government should be run as efficiently as possible. We wouldn't have the government build interstates if business could just do that. We wouldn't have, if you would, the FAA system in place, I think, if business just would have done it one day. So I think there's some natural functions. I would also suggest the functions tend to be to keep people safe, our national defense, that's not necessarily a business function, and to make sure we protect people's health and safety, and that we protect them from predatory economic activity, the overwhelming number of businesses, as in everything else in our life, are law-abiding, give back to the community, treat their employees well, but sometimes they don't. You need an arbiter to protect people from those kinds of actions, and sometimes the government fails in their responsibility, and corrective action should be taken. But the government should be as efficient as possible. I tell people the post office is enumerated in the Constitution, if you read the Constitution. And it has a role to make sure we can communicate. Now, the way we communicate on average is much different today than 230 years ago. But we still get medicine, we still get gifts in the mail, we still get love letters in the mail. And everybody says, well, they got to make a profit. It's a function of government to allow people to communicate with each other. They should be as efficient as possible. But everything doesn't have to be a profit.
I have a follow-up question.
You, how come you get a follow-up question? Are you a student here?
Yes.
So you want to get a good education. Can I ask you what your major is?
Triple major in finance, accounting, and business analytics.
Oh. Hey, this gentleman is an accounting major. Of course, he has a triple major. I majored in accounting. You can have the floor. Go ahead.
Do you think the transition from business to politics is a hard one to make?
That's an interesting, you know what? You also get a gold star in being very serious. I've never been asked that question before. The question is the transition from business to government difficult? They are two different skill sets in many ways. And I can remember a business person I went to grade school with. We're still fast friends today. He thought running a campaign for Congress when you're an unemployed lawyer with no money, no name recognition, no staff, was like running a business. He did, because that's what he did, and he's good at it. And about a month later, he realized that's not his skill set. So I'm not saying they're exclusive. You have to be organized. You have to work hard. I tell people one of the most important things is to have knowledge. Getting back to the question the gentleman asked before, to know about the job that you seek, whether it is business or in public life. If it's local, do you know what municipal financing is like? Do you know what the state budget looks like? So I'm not saying they're exclusive, but they tend to be somewhat different in their characteristics. But a great number of people that I serve with have clearly made the transition. And you have physicians, you've had dentists, you've had lawyers, business people, farmers, those who have no college degree at all, serving as my colleagues in the United States Congress. So it's just different, and one of the things I'll always respect my father for, he lived to be 101, passed away last year, he was Mayor of Gary. During that first campaign, and I would not be standing here, all kidding, I wouldn't be without him and the advice he gave me. But every once in a while, and it shows what a smart guy he was, he said, I don't know now because things change. Things always evolve. And he says, here's where I think you can find out how to do that. So you don't have to know everything. The thing is who to respect and where to go to get good information. And it's key in the job I have. Key in the job I have.
A little later in the conversation at that forum, the congressman spoke to a senior who, at the start of the event, did not stand, as the others did in the room, for the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
Sir, I noticed you did not stand, and that's your right, and that's your statement.
I happen to think
that that's what the pledge...
Well, we had a lady back here complaining about, you know, net neutrality. That's freedom. But the country is going to go down that path, and so what's the point? I don't get it.
I happen to think that there's something to be said to showing some respect to our country as imperfect as it is, and to continue to dedicate ourselves to making it better than we are.
That I would agree with.
There you go. And we'll stop there.
Some of the comments from the crowd at the town hall meeting with Congressman Pete Fisklosky. His town hall meetings held this past weekend. This one in particular was held in Hammond. Figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are indicating that there are drug rates of overdose deaths continuing to rise in rural areas across not only the country, but the nation as well. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Miranda Furol tells us more about the numbers that Hoosiers and lawmakers are doing to be able to combat this epidemic.
Weaving in between southern Indiana's rolling hills, State Road 46 passes through a rural but well-traveled part of the state. Brown County is known for farming, shopping, historical sites, and parks, and is home to 15,000 people. However, rural parts of the state are also becoming known as the center of the growing opioid epidemic.
It's like anything. If you want it, you can find it. I don't think that's an issue.
That's Doug Payne. He was an addict for more than a decade. He spends his spare time talking to kids about his struggle with substance abuse.
I still am a full-blown addict. I will always be an addict. And it's easier for me to go outside these doors right now and get high than it is to sit in here and talk to you.
Last week, around 400 Hoosiers heard Payne speak at the Boone County Fairgrounds in Lebanon for a rural opioid addiction symposium.
Kids are like cats. They're very curious. They want to know how it makes them feel and what's it do, you know. You know, with telling them that, you also got to tell them the end results of what's going to happen.
Payne says he's been clean for 11 years, but the temptation is always there. He says just within the past 6 months, he's seen several students die from drugs.
You just hate to see them go down that road because it's a long, long road. And sometimes it's a short road, especially with heroin and some of the things they're getting their hands on now, you know.
But Indiana is making some progress.
The opioid prescription rates have come down in the state of Indiana. That's good news. They're actually down 25% over the last 4 years. The bad news is we still have the 11th highest opioid prescription rate in the country.
The executive director for drug prevention, treatment, and enforcement, Jim McClellan, says the most effective long-term approach to preventing substance abuse is first focusing on Indiana's youth.
I heard in another county a few weeks ago two instances of great-grandparents who are raising the children because both the parents and the grandparents have substance abuse problems. This is something that's just, it's not only destroying lives, but it's devastating families and it's damaging communities all over the state.
McClellan says they plan to continue their fight against the crisis by having more opioid symposiums and creating mentoring programs for children impacted by their parents' addiction.
Nobody can do it on their own. But no drug dealer nor cartel can stand against families, schools, churches, and communities united together. In other words, by bringing the pieces together.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Miranda Fulmore.
On Friday, Kentucky got the green light to require people to get Medicaid, to go to work. Seema Verma is the federal official who's in charge of Medicaid, and her home state is Indiana, which is likely to get a similar approval soon. It's quite a big change from what happened under the Obama administration, but some say the work requirement may be good politics, but it's bad policy. And Side Effect Public Media's Jake Harper has that.
Indiana submitted plans for a work requirement last year, and the approval letter could come any day now. Under the proposal, people would have to average 20 hours a week of work or another qualifying activity such as volunteering or education in order to get Medicaid. The goal, to increase employment among Medicaid recipients. But Sarah Rosenbaum, a professor at George Washington University, says there's a problem with that. Most people on Medicaid are already working.
Or they're looking for work. And if they're not working or looking for work, it's typically because they're either caring for very young children, or they're caring for a sick family member, or their own health is bad.
Many of those people would be exempt from a work requirement, and states could make some allowances for people battling addiction. When you consider those exemptions,
there is this very, very tiny slice of people who can work and simply choose not to work and, you know, apply for public assistance.
But Rosenbaum says even if states create programs that help people find jobs and provide things like childcare and transportation, there's no evidence that they lead to more employment. And those programs are expensive.
If you do a work program, it costs real money. And the federal government has said we won't pay any of those costs.
So Rosenbaum says what's more likely is that states will basically say, get a job on your own or get off of Medicaid. So what that does is create a hurdle for everybody on Medicaid. People who are working are going to have to prove it. So even people with jobs could stand to lose their insurance due to red tape. In fact, Indiana's own projections show that with a work requirement, Medicaid will cover fewer people and cost more. Adam Mueller is an attorney at Indiana Legal Services, which helps people navigate the state's Medicaid program. He says people already lose coverage because the program can be confusing and there are administrative errors.
Somewhere along the way, paperwork gets lost. There's a miscommunication. Folks have sometimes had difficulty proving things that should be as easy as residency.
And he says people in Medicaid often deal with crises. They may move a lot or change phone numbers, which makes it hard to keep track of paperwork.
There are a lot of things that could trip folks up, and that could lead to falling through the cracks.
Judy Solomon of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities points out that expanded Medicaid helps some employers, too.
We have an economic structure where there are people whose employment doesn't provide health care.
If people lose Medicaid, get sick, and can't make it to work, she says that's bad for business. Seema Verma, who's in charge of Medicaid, said on a conference call yesterday the requirement is supposed to help people.
People moving off of Medicaid is a good outcome because we hope that that means that they don't need the program anymore, that they have transitioned to a job that provides health insurance or that they can afford to pay for health insurance on their own.
But advocates say the main purpose of Medicaid is to provide health insurance, not increase employment. And until now, the federal government agreed. Susan Jo Thomas heads Covering Kids and Families of Indiana, which advocates for health coverage in the state. She says under new management, the philosophy surrounding work requirements has changed.
I don't know that it jives with my view of Medicaid, but my view of Medicaid now is irrelevant. It's what Seema Verma and the administration decide.
Thomas says the details of the work requirement have yet to be ironed out. She says if too many people lose insurance, she'll be raising concerns with the state. Jake Harper, SideFX Public Media.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.